You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis.
Is this the normal amount of turbulence for this route?
Yes.
Really?
Totally.
It's...
Oh, no!
What?
Oh.
I thought that I forgot my headphones.
Did they say that there was Wi-Fi in this plane? Remember. Oh, there is. Oh, you gotta pay. Why do they do that?
You're better off.
Oh, this? Oh, I know. Trust me, I'm the worst. I like sleep with it. It's like my third arm.
It's a tool. It was originally designed by and for the military and the intelligence community. The CIA and Army Ground Ops, specifically. It is a powerful and it's a dangerous tool.
You don't have a cell phone?
I use it as it was intended. And I don't dress it up and play dolly with it.
Oh, well then don't meet my mom.
That was a clip of two-time Oscar nominee Richard Jenkins in Kajillionaire, a new movie that stars Jenkins, Deborah Winger, and Westworld's Evan Rachel Wood as a family of low-level con artists who struggle to barely get by one half-baked scam at a time. Kajillionaire comes out in theaters this Friday, September 25th, and you can also see Richard Jenkins in another film opening this weekend called The Last Shift. And today, Richard Jenkins joins me on the podcast to talk about his prolific career as one of Hollywood's most reliable character actors and what it was like to finally achieve fame in his 50s on the hit HBO series Six Feet Under. He talks about some of his favorite films that he's done, including Step Brothers and The Shape of Water, why director Guillermo del Toro sometimes gives actors a little too much background on their characters, and the difference between working with the Coen brothers and the Farrelly brothers. Richard discusses his new role as a working-class man in Rust Belt, Michigan in The Last Shift and what the film has to say about racial injustice, income inequality, and finding common ground during these politically divisive times. He also talks about his role as a shameless grifter in Kajillionaire, how the film redefines the traditional family, and what it was like to battle a never-ending deluge of bubbles. Yes, I said bubbles. Coming up with Richard Jenkins in just a moment. Emmy winner and two-time Oscar nominee Richard Jenkins has had a prolific acting career in films like Step Brothers, Burn After Reading, There's Something About Mary, Jack Reacher, The Visitor, and of course 2018's The Shape of Water, as well as television series like Six Feet Under, Berlin Station, and Olive Kittredge. Now he has two films opening in theaters this Friday, September 25th. He plays a husband, father, and a con man who's not very good at what he does in Kajillionaire, and in The Last Shift, he plays an aging high school dropout who comes to a difficult realization about himself after having watched life pass him by over 38 years working at a fast food restaurant in Michigan's Rust Belt. Richard Jenkins, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
You spent, I guess, the first 14 years of your acting career at the Rhode Island Repertory Company. That's an unusual route into film and television. Most people graduate and head straight to New York or L.A., so how does a young man from, I think, DeKalb, Illinois, end up in Rhode Island?
Well, because I was hired as an apprentice, for one full season. This was 1970, when the regional theater movement in America was just really going crazy because of the National Endowment for the Arts and National Endowment for Humanities and Ford Foundation. There was a lot of support for every major city having their own theater. So I went out right after college and was an apprentice, made $65 a week at Trinity Rep in Providence. And that's how it started. And then they made me a member of the company the next year. And I stayed there for 14 years as an actor. And, you know, it was an amazing time.
And you still live in Rhode Island, is that right?
51 years, yes.
Wow. We've been here. What do you like about that life as opposed to being in New York or L.A. all the time?
Well, I like both cities. I love New York. I love L.A. like working there, like going there.
Yeah.
But Rhode Island seemed to fit our vibe. Our friends were here after 14 years. We made a lot of friends in the theater and outside of the theater. And our kids were in school here. So we thought, let's stay. You know, we love the state. You know, it has a lot to offer. It's close to New York, close to Boston. Nothing's really close to L.A. unless you live in L.A.
Yeah,
I mean that. So that was the choice. And we wondered if I wondered if I could kind of have a career from here. And so we decided to try.
Yeah, and you've had a hell of a career, but you're sort of a late bloomer in a sense, because I guess you didn't land your first film role until you were 36, worked pretty steadily for years as a character actor, but really got your first break with Six Feet Under when you were in your 50s, got your first Oscar nomination at, I think, 60. Do you ever wonder what took so long for Hollywood to recognize you, or why you didn't hit it big when you were in your 20s and 30s?
No, I still haven't hit it big. You know, I mean, it's I'm an actor, and it's like I was never a juvenile, which is a term for a young, handsome actor. I was never that. I figured I would work more the older I get. You know, and the more my hair fell out, the more I worked. It was that's how it kind of happens. I'm glad it took a long time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I wasn't at the time. I was worried. How am I going to educate my children? But at the same time, I did a lot of interesting things along the way. I've been working as an actor since I was 22 years old. I supported myself. My wife, thank God, had a job, or we would have been in trouble. But that's been my job. I wasn't, you know, doing some other profession and trying to be an actor. I was working as an actor. So all those years.
Yeah.
In Providence and all the small roles I did in films and television. I mean, I was grateful.
Yeah.
Really grateful.
Yeah. And I love those actors like yourself who really come into it later in their life because, you know, as much as we want to talk about how hard the business is, it's a real testament to how this business works and the fact that if you keep plugging away and getting better at your craft, sooner or later, almost inevitably, you're going to get noticed.
Well, luck plays a huge part in it. And I'm not saying that to be humble. It's true. It's absolutely true. And I think most actors will tell you that luck is huge. Because I know a lot of talented actors that haven't had the breaks that I have. But at the same time, if you're meant to do this, I believe there's room for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And you will figure it out if you're really meant to be an actor. If not, you end up doing something else. It's a weird thing. Sometimes it takes people 5-10 years to say, this is not really for me. This is not what I. But if you're somebody like me who had never occurred to you to do anything else, so you keep plugging away. It's not anything noble. It's just I just couldn't imagine doing anything else.
Really? So you never had a plan B, or has it? It's just always been acting or bust for you, huh?
No, but. You're always your advisors in school. I always said, you need something to fall back on in case you don't become an actor. Why don't you be a history minor? I said, then I would fall back on that. How would that work? I never understood that. But no. But, you know, it's funny because a lot of the actors that I grew up with, they were in school with, that started out and decided to do something else are almost all very successful.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. They've done really well in life, doing other things.
And you've steadily worked as a character actor for a long time. I don't know about you, but most of my favorite actors are actually character actors, guys like Stanley Tucci, Michael Shannon, Michael Stuhlbarg. But I wonder how you feel about the term character actor. Have you embraced it, or do you think it undersells what a supporting actor does?
No, I mean, that's, you're an actor and you do characters. That's what you are. I don't mind it at all. It's what I am. It's what I always have been. Mm-hmm. I've always been character actor. I've always done, I've been really fortunate to do a lot of interesting things, a lot of different kinds of people. I don't mind it at all.
But I have to think that it's a challenge when you're doing supporting parts or a character role, because the rest of the cast and crew, you know, they may have had a few weeks to feel out each other and build some camaraderie. And then you parachute onto set with maybe a handful of pages and only a few scenes, a couple of days to really build a character. Does that make it difficult to jump in there and make your mark on a movie?
Well, that's not what a character actor is.
Okay.
A character actor is a person who plays, something other than a lead. I mean, mm-hmm. I guess that's how it's defined.
Okay.
But you know, if you're somebody comes in for, which I've done many times in my life, and most actors have, you go in and to a TV series and you have one day's work, mm-hmm. or, you know, it is harder because everybody's friends, and that's exactly the you know, that's it. Everybody's worked together. They got a rhythm down, and then you come in. But I have to say, in all of the years that I've made movies, I can't remember, and I mean, I may be wrong here, but I can't remember anybody coming in for one day that wasn't just wonderful.
Really?
Because you think of the process. If there's a part that has one scene only, mm-hmm. but they have 20 lines to 30 lines, and it's a scene, whatever the scene is, how many people do they look at for that part? How many people do they say, well, it might be too tall, might be too this, and too old, too young? And then how many people read for that part? And then it's down to the last person, and they get, it's very competitive. And I've never seen somebody come in there who was awful. Or bad.
That's interesting. The winnowing process.
It's my way of saying there's a lot of great actors out there.
Yeah,
there's a ton of great actors. And you know, an actor who makes a living doing what he does is a successful actor. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of people out there that do these parts. They shouldn't be diminished because that's the size of the role. They're fabulous actors. Mm-hmm. And it's very competitive.
Yeah, and I want to talk to you about those early years when you were sort of struggling to make it in the business and make ends meet in the 80s and 90s. You must have had to suck it up and take some bad roles or decent roles in bad movies just for the paycheck. I wonder if you had a magic eraser, can you think of something that you would want to erase from your IMDb page?
No, because it's, you know, one job may have helped pay for something my children needed or help buy a car we needed, or, you know, yeah, you do. You have no choice. You have no choice. If you want to be an actor, you go and audition. And if they give you the part, you know, you take it. And you audition for everything they ask you to audition for. You know, I didn't have the luxury of saying, I don't like this part. Mm-hmm. It wasn't part of the deal. Right. I mean, when the time comes when you can say that and no, thank you, or this doesn't seem right for me, that's a wonderful place to be.
Yeah.
But it didn't happen for a long, long time.
Have you been enjoying having that luxury to be able to turn down a script nowadays?
Well, it's, I don't look at it as a luxury or something, but it's like at my age, I don't really want to do anything that I don't really want to do. Mm-hmm. Because it's 6 months now is a long time.
Yeah.
And when I was 35, it was 6 months. But now that I'm 73, 6 months is a long time. And so I'm pretty careful about what I choose to do. And it's usually something that the writing interests me, or the part has to interest me. Mm-hmm. I just don't want to do something because it's a great group. And if it's a part that means nothing to me, then it's not worth doing. So, but, you know, it's like my time became more valuable the older I got.
So then how big of a turning point was it for you when you landed that role as the father in Six Feet Under? Do you think of that as your big break or what?
Well, I've had a lot of breaks that kind of happened before. I mean, the fact that I was even considered for Six Feet Under came after I did Flirting with Disaster, which is a movie you haven't seen, probably. But it's a David O. Russell movie.
No, I love that movie.
It's a fabulous, Oh, you have seen it. Okay.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. It's
hilarious. But that led to Six Feet Under. And I don't know what led to Flirting with Disasters, but something else led to maybe been The Witches of Eastwick. You know, so it's everything is, you look back and you go, oh, you know that, if I hadn't done that, then this wouldn't have happened. If I had done that, this wouldn't have happened. And, you know, I went and I read for 6 Feet Under, and I was supposed to appear in the pilot only, just that was the script, and I wasn't a regular character on it. And then after we did the pilot, Alan Ball said, would you come back and do, you know, be a recurring character? Because, you know, when your father dies, you don't stop thinking about it.
And that's fascinating. I didn't realize that. I always thought that part was written into the whole season. Okay. I didn't realize
that. Well, I mean, after the pilot, then, but, you know, if I was working, I couldn't come in and do something. So they kind of worked around. It was, so I would do, I don't know, 2 or 3 a year, maybe. And it was always it was great. It was great. And yes, that did help immensely.
And what I found so interesting about that role is you weren't really playing the father as he was or as he would have been. You were playing sort of the ghost of the father as seen through different family members' eyes. So in essence, you were sort of playing slightly different characters depending on who you were interacting with. How did you approach that?
I think you're the first person that said that to me. And that's
really
the truth. I never knew who this guy was.
Really?
I never knew, because depending on who was thinking about him, he was totally different. Not totally different, but he wasn't the same guy. I wasn't the same with my sons as I was with my daughter, as well as my wife. It was, everybody saw me in a different way, which is kind of how we view people.
True.
You know, we all have our own hooks and emotional memories and opinions about people, and sometimes two people are talking about somebody and you can't believe it's the same person. Well, that's the character. That's who I was. And I'm the only ghost who aged.
Oh yeah, that's true. I guess so.
I got 5 years older.
I love it. Yeah, I mean, that must have been an interesting challenge for you as an actor, because you're playing the same person, but what, you have to slightly tweak it depending on who you're playing against?
Well, you see what's there. You know, it's all there in the script. And
right.
And you say, oh, gee, I didn't know I was this large of an asshole. I mean, I thought I was more compassionate than that, but you know, it's how they, or where they are emotionally at the moment. You know, might not have anything to do with you.
Yeah.
But it's just, you think of something your father said to you that was mean or that was hurtful, and it becomes gigantic for that moment. And you appear and you say it, you know? So it was kind of brilliant the way they structured this guy. And Alan knew immediately. I mean, he knew that, and we never talked about it, but I think I did say once, I have no idea who this man is.
Yeah. And you have kind of become the go-to guy for a number of directors. You've made, I want to say, 4 movies with the Coen brothers, 5 movies with another set of brother filmmakers, the Farrelly brothers. You know, there aren't a lot of brother filmmaker teams out there. I'm just curious, what did you observe about how the Farrellys interact with each other on set versus how the Coen brothers work together? Was there a contrast between those two relationships?
Well, as some actress said, well, there were 2 of them. That's one thing. No, they work together well, or they wouldn't keep making movies together.
Sure.
They have their own system, each one of them. Peter directs more than Bobby, but Bobby's there with the camera and they talk. They go back and they talk, and Peter comes in. So you don't know what they're talking about, but you know, Bobby does a lot of the rewriting and he's watching, and Peter, they're real collaborators. And same with Joel and Ethan. You know, Joel kind of directs and Ethan's there watching, and they talk and they write, and so it's a collaboration with them. And I always feel that when I'm hearing something, I'm hearing it from both guys, you know, that it was a, but you know, that it was a consensus that they came to, but you know, the truth is I can't prove that. I have no idea. It may be some idea Joel had and just did it, or Ethan had. And did it.
Yeah.
So I don't.
I've heard other actors tell me that, I guess, they sort of almost operate in a telepathic manner. You know, they can just look at one another and know what the other's thinking, then change up a shot or something like that.
Well, you know, they're so invested in the project and the script, they know it better than anybody else.
Sure.
And they've talked about it and written it together. And, you know, there's an intimacy there that is, you know, and they've worked together so many times that they know how it works best for the two of them. Either Bobby or Peter or Joel and Ethan, they both have figured out that process for the two of them. So it's, you know, it doesn't seem like there's two people directing you, but at the same time, there probably is, but it doesn't seem that way.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. Now, of course, people know you very well from The Shape of Water, which earned you your second Oscar nomination. You got to work with the great Guillermo del Toro. I've heard about him that just beyond the script, he tends to write a full Bible of background information for every character in his movies. Did he do that for your character, Giles? And what did you get out of that?
Yes, he did. By the way, I just finished his new movie, Nightmare Alley.
Oh, wow.
Just got back, shaved my beard yesterday. He's amazing. Guillermo is just the best. I mean, he's just a great man. He's a great wonderful man. Yes, he does. He writes. He's so invested in this world that he creates, and he writes these wonderful 8-10 page backstories for everybody. And he said, you take it, and if it helps you, fine. If not, you don't have it. So he gave me mine, and the next day he said, did you read it? I said, yes. And you're going to use it? I said, no. And he said, why? I said, because it's not on the page. It's not, if you put it in the movie, I'll deal with it. But you know, how I feel about my mom, how does that fit into this world? So, but you know, it's fascinating to read. And during the Golden Globes, when I lost, he turned to me and he said, if you'd used the backstory, you might have won.
That's great. I wonder, when people come up to you these days, what do you get recognized from more, The Shape of Water or Step Brothers?
Oh, gosh, there's a million things I get recognized for. It depends on the age group. You know, Dear John, I get recognized a lot for that. Friends with Benefits for a long time. I got Step Brothers always. Step Brothers. It used to be just young people, but not so much anymore.
Oh, really?
A lot of people have seen Step Brothers. And The Shape of Water, yes. 6 Feet Under, I get recognized for that. People don't stop me very often, so it's not like...
Really? Even now?
Yeah, I mean, the people are nice. People are very sweet. You know, they don't make a big deal out of anything. And it's nice, but I would say Step Brothers is the one that... I'm most recognized.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about these two movies that you have coming out this weekend. First of all, I loved Kajillionaire. It's just so hilarious and heartwarming and weird all at the same time. It's exactly the kind of quirky independent film that I start to look for around this time of the summer after all the studio blockbusters and the comic book movies come out. Tell the listeners a little bit about the film. It's sort of an atypical take on the traditional family unit, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a story of a family of grifters who are petty criminals getting by. I don't know how they get by, but they only have $1,500 anywhere, and they're really bad at it. But it's the way they deal with the world. This husband and wife, who Deborah Winger and I, and have this daughter, Evan Rachel Wood, and it's... We show her no affection. We don't treat her like a child. We treat her as an equal partner. We split everything three ways. and she's emotionally, say, undergrown. Yeah. She's and has no connection with the outer world and love and feelings and, you know, anything except the score. Mm-hmm. And I preach this thing of, like, I like to slide by in life. I don't like to be hooked on anything. I don't like to have a job. I don't do that stuff. I mean, it's, and then she meets this woman who becomes part of our team. And I shouldn't keep talking about it because it's, I'll give everything away.
Sure.
But there's a real emotional breakthrough for her. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty beautiful.
Now, I'm used to seeing you playing fairly empathetic characters. Was it fun to play a shameless con artist, play the heel?
Well, I never felt it. I always thought he thought he was doing the right thing by his kid. I mean, I think that's the way we all look at actors, look at roles. You know, I never thought he was an idiot. You know, I know that the last scene in the restaurant where she kind of pulls away from them, they're really taken aback by that. Mm-hmm. And he actually says some things to her that he's never said before. So I just, I never thought of me. He's useless, but I never thought of him as an evil guy.
Yeah. Even though this family, you know, they're con artists, they also have this weirdly rigid sense of morality that looks down on mainstream society. How would you describe their worldview and particularly your character?
As conspiracy theorists, kind of what they are, you know. I may not even be in the movie now, but I said once, seatbelts don't work; they just don't work. It's a con by the car companies to get you in, you know, and by the insurance companies. And flying is the most dangerous way of traveling. We all know that, you know. It's all this stuff. This guy,
not true at all.
He's like a conspiracy theorist. Yeah. I mean, he is the. Everything that he thinks everything is 180 of the truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Your character, Robert, he has this huge level of confidence that is wildly out of step with his circumstances in life. And he speaks with just an odd degree of certitude on everything from materialism to earthquakes. And as I watched Gajillionaire, I thought to myself, I kind of know this guy, you know, from the White House on down. There are those people who just have no clue what they're talking about, and yet they second guess nothing, and they propagate conspiracy theories and disinformation, but they do so with such conviction that it can be hard to challenge them. In that sense, do you think that Robert is sort of a reflection of where we are as a society right now?
Yes, I do, in many ways, you know, and it, some of it is so ridiculous. You think, well, nobody can. Well, please. I mean, look at some things people believe today, and you can imagine growing up with parents like this, where your head would be. I mean, it's just it's crazy, and so that's why this, when she has a chance to see the world as it is, it's a wonderful thing.
Yeah. And I have to say that the other thing that distinguishes this movie for me is. It's funny because when I think of grifter movies, the ones that come to mind are films like The Sting, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, where the thieves are glamorous and sexy and smart and pull off some huge score by the end. There aren't a lot of movies about bad con artists who set their sights so low that the con is barely worth it. It's like they never seem to look at the return on their investment or the risk versus the reward of their scams, do they?
I think most of the folks out there that do this are scraped and bought, you know?
Really?
I mean, I don't think it's glamorous. I think that it's a lot, you know, I mean, but you don't see this. You don't, I mean, the shirt I wore, I wanted this big shirt and we decided, yeah, that's good. I said, it's something, you know, his wife won or he stole somewhere and it doesn't fit him and his pants don't fit and his shoes look like they came from, you know, whatever, it's all free. It's all free. And he thinks he's beat the system because you look at him, he's walking down the street. I mean, he looks like he should be incarcerated somewhere. I mean, it's like, who is this guy? That's what when I see people sometimes, I don't know if you do this, but I look at him and say, what's his story? Where does he come from? Who are his parents? You know, where did he go to school? Where did he grow up? Did he have parents?
Yeah.
You know, that stuff is, and that's, I love people like that. And that's to me what Robert is. Seeing if I were to walk down the street, because he doesn't, is he homeless or is he just strange? What is he? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't want to give anything away, but I do want to say I love the hot tub scene in that movie.
Well, there it is.
My wife and I laugh so hard.
What world is he living in?
Yeah.
He thinks this is going to work. You
know? Yeah, I mean, exactly.
And plus it's so creepy. I mean, it's so creepy.
Yeah. I love it when Deborah Winger's character walks in with a plate of cheese and crackers in a seduction scene.
I know. It's like, it's just...
And one of the highlights of the film is the fact that the family's home is a rented office space with one very major design flaw involving masses of pink bubbles leaking from the ceilings. And they have the Sisyphean task of having to clean up this mess twice a day, three times on Wednesday. As I describe it right now, it's almost impossible to imagine unless you see the movie. How did the director pitch that scene to you? Were you skeptical that you could pull it off technically?
No, it's fun. It's always fun to do that. I mean, we had to get a system down where, you know, like we've been doing it for years and, you know, we don't talk, we just go do it. And thank goodness there's a drain in the bathroom that we put the stuff down. But yeah, it's a bubble factory we're next to. And every day, twice a day, the bubbles come through them all. And yeah, it was fun.
Now, I'm a big Westworld fan. What was it like to work with Evan Rachel Wood?
Well, Evan's great. She's fantastic. And I didn't know she sang. And she's an incredible singer. And we went to see her in a club in L.A. And, I mean, she just blew me away. She's so good. So I started. She was doing a set on names, songs with her people's names. And I said, here's a song called Emily. Tony Bennett sang years ago, and I don't think she knew Tony Bennett.
I remember that song.
And so it's a pretty song. It's from a movie. I think it's from the Americanization of Emily. I think that's what it's from.
Okay.
I think. I could be wrong.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
And so she fell in love with Tony Bennett. I just heard him sing. In My Solitude, I think that's the name of it, or Solitude, I don't know, on the Steve Allen Show on YouTube. And he sings this medley, and in the middle of it, he sings this dramatic ballad about a man losing his mind because his girl left him. And I sent this to her, and I said, because she can sing anything. I said, you would kill this. And she said, oh my God. So I said, you have to do it. She said, I will. I said, well, you got to send me the tape when you do. So I adore her. She's so great.
Yeah, you sort of play the same role with Evan that I play with my wife, because I'm a huge fan of Tony Bennett, always have been since I was a kid.
And
you know, she has no idea. We try to go to the Hollywood Bowl every year to see Tony Bennett, and she gets excited when Lady Gaga walks on stage with him. But
yeah,
well, I'm just there to see Tony Bennett every year.
But you know, it's funny because Evan's young, and I mean, Tony Bennett's not in her wheelhouse. Why would it be? You know, there's so many young singers I don't know about. But when she heard him, she just got it. Mm-hmm. She just got it. You know, she just said, "Oh my goodness, this."
Yeah, he's amazing, and he's still at it in his mid-90s, I think, now.
Go listen to this. Go on YouTube and find this.
Yeah, I will.
And he sings a medley on the show, and he's 30 years old and kind of the height of his powers, and he just is so great.
Yeah, great. Yeah, he's great. Frank Sinatra's favorite singer, too. Did you know that?
Yeah, I know.
Well, let's talk about the other movie that you have coming out this weekend. I don't know if this is the first for you, having two movies opening on the same weekend, but you have The Last Shift also coming out.
Yeah.
And you play a high school dropout who has spent 38 years of his life working at a fast food restaurant, where he ends up training his replacement, a young black man who has sort of an activist streak. And over the series of a few nights, they hash it out over racism, income inequality, white privilege, the Flint water crisis, etc. The timing of this film, in the wake of the George Floyd murder and the Black Lives Matter protest, it's completely on point. In fact, I think that the young man is on probation for defacing a city monument. I wonder, this film can't have been filmed after all that. So all of this just happened to come about at the right time, huh? I guess the right time was probably not the right phrasing there, but it is amazing that this film was shot up before all of this happened, and it's incredibly relevant.
Well, yeah, I mean, this, you know, race has been bubbling in this country for a long time, you know, the issue of this whole thing. It just, but yeah, we made it last summer in Chicago. It was at Sundance, went to Sundance with it. And but right now it is, you know, the timing is what it is. But
yeah. They come at social issues from two very different points of view in a lot of cases. For instance, the young man Javon talks about systemic racism, while your character Stanley accuses him of playing the race card. And yet they find some connection, maybe not agreement, but some sort of understanding of where each other is coming from. Don't you feel like these are the kind of conversations that should be happening all over America right now?
It's like they have more in common than they realize. Mm-hmm. And that's what Javon says to him. And that's why when they don't connect, I think it's a statement too about two people who have more in common than they know, especially Stanley, you know, and just doesn't seem to understand that.
And Stanley is an older, white, blue-collar guy in the Rust Belt who has fairly conservative takes on race and social issues, and yet he's not really a stereotype. He's a human being. We empathize with him.
He's a good guy. He's a good guy.
I wonder, did playing him maybe give you some insight into those older, white, working-class men in places like Michigan who voted for Trump because they felt like they'd been overlooked or written off or somehow robbed of their dignity?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, it's, that's what I wanted. And that's why I really loved the script when I read it, because he wasn't a jerk. Mm-hmm. He was a guy who tried in his world, tried to do the right thing in his mind. And he liked Javon. He likes him. And Javon opens his eyes about things like, you know what they're paying you? I mean, it's like, and he thinks he's getting a great deal. And here's this young kid coming along saying, what are you talking about? I did. We've all known people like this. We've all been frustrated by people like this. At the same time, you know, this guy, he's a good man. He's not a bad man. Mm-hmm. He just is ignorant.
Having grown up in Illinois, do you kind of know the world in which this film takes place?
I do. I do. You know, it's Stanley, I don't think, was ever really around people of color. I mean, he was around them, but he wasn't really in. He didn't know them. He didn't deal with them. He didn't interact with them. So, you know, he has an opinion. Mm-hmm. And it comes from all those around him who tell him what he should think or what's going on. And it's easy. It's an easy way out just to say, oh, yeah, okay, yeah. That's it. And it's easy to say, you know, I worked hard all my life and nobody ever gave me anything. And don't tell me about white privilege, you know, but he doesn't understand that, yeah, he has worked hard. Nobody ever said that he hasn't. And he has struggled. Okay. But he's never had an issue because of the color of his skin. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing that's never been a problem for him. And, you know, he just doesn't see that. That doesn't come into the equation. Mm-hmm. So, I love the film because it's right. Javon is the only one in the movie who grows. Stanley needs it's, and I said it's really Javon's film, because he's the guy who makes a decision in his life to do something. Partly because he's seen Stanley, and you know, and where Stanley is after 68 years, you know, he's got all these theories. I mean, I love the character, and I think the film is, I just think it's terrific. I had such fun making it.
There's this quality in Stanley that we recognize in some people that we meet out there, that he sees value and dignity in a job well done, even if it's a minimum wage job with very few benefits and probably not much of a retirement plan. And this young kid, Javon, kind of opens his eyes to the raw deal that he's gotten out of life.
Yeah. And it's also sad that somebody who is, you know, is a good soldier, mm-hmm, like Stanley, gets taken advantage of.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what Javon opens his eyes to. It's like, you know, come on, you talk about these people, you know, the guy who owns this thing is like, he's some great benefactor here. You know what he's paying you? Nothing. And you see what kind of a gift that he gets when he retires. I think it's a $50 gift certificate to Dick's Sporting Goods. You know, you buy one shoe. I don't know what you're gonna do after 38 years. So
not even a watch.
I think Andrew Cohen really, he understands these people, yeah, and really wrote a terrific piece. Right. And it's fun.
And I believe he has a background in the documentary world, right?
Yeah. So. He's from Michigan, and you know, he's this is the first narrative film that he's written, but it's really nice. I just love it.
Yeah. Yeah. Both of these films are terrific. And it's interesting because as different as these two movies are, it's kind of fun to watch them alongside each other because they're both sort of men who have put a lot of effort into their work only to receive a pretty terrible return on their investment, whether honestly or dishonestly.
I know. That's the, my gosh. Yeah. Stanley's apartment, you know, that one foray into the little room where he has to lock three times because there were rumors, there were people living in the rooming house. You know, it's just, what does he have from his life?
Yeah.
A high school ring that he never graduated. He has it, but he didn't graduate. But he bought it. They ordered it their junior year and it came and he paid for it. Yeah. So he figured he'd wear it. Which I love.
Yeah, they're both excellent films. I highly recommend that people see them both this weekend. Kajillionaire and The Last Shift come out this Friday in theaters on September 25th, and Kajillionaire will be available on video on demand October 16th. Richard Jenkins, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Thanks again to Richard Jenkins for coming on the show. Once more, Kajillionaire and The Last Shift open in theaters on September 25th, and Kajillionaire comes out on video on demand starting October 16th. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com. And I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.